Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
You want to hear a great story? I mean, a great story. Life-changing, world-altering story of jesters and queens and crowns and scepters, villains, and heroes. That's the story of Esther. We're going to study that story of Esther today. We'll continue in that we've been looking into over these. This is our second week now. And it's such a fabulous, it looks simple, but it's actually profound. It is a genius work. It is still to this day one of the favorite stories of Jews, especially when they are in a context of persecution at the threat of annihilation. This little book is the one they appeal to. And the reason we're studying it, the reason I like it so much, is that it says a lot about how God works, like literally his method of operating in the world that we live in. Our lives are much more like Esther than they are maybe any other book in the Bible. And so let's pay very close attention to what God's doing, especially behind the scenes. Let me just remind you of what we looked at last week. We looked at the first two chapters of this great book, and we're introduced to some characters, three major characters. One of them is Esther herself. Let's just kind of picture her being maybe a six-year-old girl, and she's weeping, and she's standing in front of two brand new grave sites. Those are her mom and her dad. She's an orphan. We called her an innocent and even naive little orphan girl, and she's left in the world in many respects by herself. Her cousin Mordecai, he's 30 years old, and he's standing next to her, holding her hand and saying, I'll take that role as your father. I'll raise you like my own. And so they live that life, and he never misses Sabbath school with her, and he's teaching her the ways of life and keeping her innocent and pure and hopeful and spirited. It's a great story. And then you fast forward 10 or years or so, and then suddenly in a normal day of their life, like any other day of their life, but this time the king's guards are coming into every single house and kicking doors in and looking through the barns and every single closet, and they're looking for young, beautiful, virgin girls. And Esther qualifies. And so they grab Esther, and they're pulling her away from the hands of Mordecai. And they, why would you do this? And the guards say, well, because the former queen Vashti made the king mad. She told him no. And now they're looking for a queen that'll take her place, that'll do what she's told, and will stand in line. And your daughter here, Esther, she'll qualify for that. So Mordecai just pleads a case and says, look, could I just have a second with this little girl? And so 16, 17-year-old Esther, Mordecai looks into her eyes and says, look, two rules. Don't tell him you're a Jew, and don't make him mad. Torn away, taken to the castle in Susa, and there with maybe 1,000 different girls that are in there, and they're just getting initiated into the process. And Haggai, he's the king's head eunuch, and he says, okay, here's what's going to happen. For a year, you're going to be preparing yourself for one night with a king. And we'll teach you all the rules of etiquette and how to treat this man, because let me tell you, around here, we pretty much have one rule: don't make him mad. We'll teach you how to take care of yourself, and we'll feed you the king's food, and then you'll go into his bedroom, and you'll have one night with him. And if he likes you, maybe he'll have you back. If he really likes you, maybe he'll remember your name. If he especially likes you, you could be the next queen. And that's how it goes. If you're not his queen, you'll just disappear. We'll send you off to some other dormitory, and you'll live the rest of your life with other girls, and that'll be that. And so when Esther comes in, for some reason, I think she's just lucky, honestly, because Haggai, the head eunuch, he really likes her. He kind of has something for her. And so he delegates his best assistants to Esther for this 1 year of preparation. And then when her night is called and she goes in, she listens to Haggai and she does what she's told. She does that, She's very compliant. She does what her father kind of guy, Mordecai, she does what he says, and now she's obeying Haggai, the chief eunuch. And so she goes in there and she wins the king's heart somehow. I don't know if you call this winning, but she gets to be the queen. Maybe she's just lucky, but she gets to be queen. And this is not a Cinderella story because Xerxes, he's now Prince Charming. He is crazy and evil and moody and vicious. And she gets to be his queen. Well, banquets. They have a banquet for Esther, Queen Esther. It's Queen Esther's banquet, it's called there. And banquets are very important to Xerxes. As a matter of fact, it's very important to this book. The key to the book is knowing banquets, oddly enough. Anyway, they're having this big banquet for Esther, and Mordecai is able to get one more message into her, and he says this, now that you're queen, two things, two rules. One, don't tell him you're a Jew. And two, don't make him mad. Don't make him mad. Now, soon after that, Mordecai is apparently hanging around the castle walls now just to send messages in if he can, but he's kind of fitting into the woodwork there, and apparently just he overhears two people conspiring to kill King Xerxes, the king that stole his daughter, and he chooses to do the right thing. He's lucky enough to hear that, and so he's going to do something with that, and he sends a message to Esther. And he says, Esther, you need to tell the king that these two men are out to kill him. And Xerxes looks into it, and it turns out the conspiracy was, in fact, based on truth. And these two men will be punished. What does Xerxes do to people that are traitors in his kingdom? He takes them out just outside the city walls and impales them on these sharp poles that are several feet high so that they can hang there in the Middle Eastern sun and rot. And then everyone will know. You don't conspire against the king. And that was the message that was very clear to everyone. So what does the king do? Not to the traitors. How does the king honor the man who saved his life? He doesn't. He doesn't give him any honor. And that's a little bit curious because Xerxes, as crazy as he is, he's also known for being quite generous. And so the end of chapter 2 ends with this a bit of a thud because Mordecai gets nothing for helping the king out, the king that stole his daughter. It's a great story. Chapter 3 opens up, but we can't just go into the fourth character. Again, we have no Mordecai. He's that shrewd Jew. And Esther, she's the innocent orphan, and Xerxes, the crazy king. To tell a really great story, you need about 1,000 years sometimes. And this one, it's a 1,000-year-old story. If you go back 1,000 years from when Esther was written, you go to the book of Exodus in chapter 12, and that is the very birthday of Israel. That's when the nation is birthed out of Egypt. That's their Independence Day. It's the Passover, and they're coming out, and not soon after that they're born, and they're just learning to walk on their own, this ragbag tribe called the Amalekites tries to kill them all. Because they know, the Amalekites, they know that these Jews have no clue of what war looks like. They've been making bricks for the last 400 years. What are they going to do, throw a brick at us? And so from the very beginning of Israel's history, the Amalekites were like these flea-bitten jackals that feed on the weak and the naive. The Amalekites were never big favorites to God because they were trying to kill his people off. Well, you go 500 years from the Exodus, 500 years back from Esther, and I'm rounding, but that's when the kingdom period began. And the first kingdom period was ruled by the first king, King Saul. King Saul's from this tribe called the Benjamites, the Benjamin. Okay, there's 12 tribes of Israel. His tribe was tribe of Benjamin. And as being the first king, one of the very first commands that he gets from God is it is time to deal with these Amalekites. From the beginning of Israel's history and for the last 500 years, they've been hunting us and trying to kill us, all of us, and completely wipe us off the map. And now we will do the same to them. And then we'll never have to deal with them again. The king of the Amalekites at this time is a man named Agag. Agag. Now, when you turn your Bibles to Esther chapter 3, you need to know this, that Mordecai is a Benjamite. Of the 12 tribes, He's from Benjamin. He's a descendant of Saul. This new guy that we're talking about, his name is Haman, and he's an Agagite. He's in the direct descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites. That tribe that didn't completely get killed off because Saul didn't completely obey 500 years earlier. And so this is round three of a 1,000-year grudge war about life and death, not of a few, but of all. And so in contrast to Mordecai the Benjamite that just saved Xerxes' life, who should be receiving honor for that, we open to chapter 3, verse 1, and we find out this man named Haman, the Agagite, he's the one that's receiving all the honor. This story is not a fair story. There seems to be little justice in it. Look at verse 3, 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. And after all these events, that is that Mordecai just saved the king's life, King Xerxes honored Haman, the son of this guy, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him the seat of honor higher than all of the other nobles. And all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai, the Benjamite, he would not kneel down or pay him honor. So here's what I want you to understand about Haman. If you thought the villain in the story of Esther is Xerxes because he's crazy and cruel, no. We've just gone from bad to worst with this guy named Haman because he is literally bred to kill Jews. He is destined for evil. Xerxes is just kind of following his passions. Haman, he's wrong. And he, right, did you see what it said? Xerxes honors him. He has Xerxes' ear. If he gets Xerxes' ring, there'll be no Jews at the end of this story. And so when he walks in, because it's the king's command, every time he walks in through the gates of the palace of Susa, everyone bows to their knees and then puts their heads down, except Mordecai, the Jew, the Benjamite. He stands there with his arms folded and looking up. And I know it's easy to imagine what that looks like, but I want you to see just for a second. Jim, why don't you stand up and turn the house lights on? Jim will play Mordecai. Look at him. Now, here's the odd thing. You don't see 600 or 700 people sitting down right now, do you? You see one man standing up with his arms folded in defiance and looking up. Thank you, Jim. That's what Haman saw, and he saw it every single day. It says day after day, it says that Haman would walk in and Mordecai would stand there. And so word got back to him about who this Mordecai is, and listen to what it says in chapter 5, verse 3. It says, then Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. It enraged him. Yet having learned that Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. That would be too easy. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the entire kingdom of Xerxes. So Haman finds out who Mordecai is and says, wait a minute, he's Jewish? Oh, I like to kill Jews, all the Jews. And so first, he needs a date. He needs to figure out what the gods say, what fate says, what luck says would be a good time to kill everyone. And so he consults the sorcerers, and they roll the dice. They draw a lot, and they find out here's the good day to do that, the 11th month of the year, the 13th day. That will be the day of infamy. That will be the day of destruction of all the Jews. Got it. Now I've got to get permission from the king. And so he goes to the king and he tells the king, there's a group of people that do not honor our customs. I'm sorry, your customs, King Xerxes. And I think they need to be taught a lesson. And I will pay you 300 tons of silver if you let me take this and deal with it. And Xerxes kind of impressed with his commitment. And so he says, you know what? In verse 10 of chapter 3, and the king said, okay, he takes his signet ring and gives it from his finger and gives it to Haman, the Agagite. Look at his title. Haman, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And he says, keep your money, said the king to Haman, and do with the people that you please. He gets the ring. And because he has the ring, he can make a decree. He can put the seal of the king on that ring. And then it will be a law of the Medes and the Persians. And it cannot be turned away. And so this is what he does. Next two verses. Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. And dispatches were sent by all couriers, okay, to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children. That's pretty clear, isn't it? Look at the date of when the pronouncement was made. The 13th day of the first month. Do you know what Jews do on the 13th day of the first month? Think of our July 3rd. July 3rd is the day before July 4th. That's the day that we celebrate that God has given us freedom. And I don't know about your family, but we're trying to get the last set of hot dogs, some ice cream at the grocery store. And when the kids were younger, we were decorating their trikes and bikes and wagons. And we're looking for a parade to go to and some fireworks to enjoy. That's what we're pretty excited about the day before the 4th. The day before the 13th is the day before Passover for Jews. That's their day of independence. That's the day that Israel was born out of Egypt. That's the day that they say, God set us free. And so while they're running around and looking at the lamb to make sure it was perfect without blemish and getting ready to do what they do to lambs and then looking for unleavened bread and decorating their houses and looking forward to the festivities that come with Passover, their favorite feast, they heard hammers banging on the center of town and some man yelling, hear ye, hear ye. Jews, you have 11 months from today, and then you will be destroyed, killed, annihilated, all of you, young and old, women and children. That's quite a mood swing, isn't it? Isn't that a terrible kind of fall? The higher you are, the farther you fall. And so they go from the day before Passover to what in the world has happened here? And just to add salt in the wound, if you don't hate Haman, look at the next verse here, verse 15. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. He's so smug. I'm just going to be up on the deck with the king Xerxes. We'll be having cocktails, celebrating 11 months to the day and counting. And we will finally get this done. We will kill every single Jew in the largest kingdom in centuries. And I will have penned it, and I hold his ring in my finger. Meanwhile, just below the deck, over the third floor, all the Jews are running wild in confusion and in terror. Their neighbors are taking inventory of their homes. I get the flat screen. And they're counting the people they'll be killing. And that's how chapter 3 ends. I told you, it's a great story. Didn't I tell you it's a great story? This story is still being told today. Last month, the Prime Minister of Israel gave our President Obama a gift in March on the 7th. He gave him the Book of Esther. And do you know why? Because where Persia used to exist, part of it is in Iran. And Iran is working on nuclear weapons to shoot at Israel so that they might destroy and kill and annihilate every Jew, young and old, men, women, and children. And so Benjamin Netanyahu, it's getting weird, isn't it? Benjamin Netanyahu gives a book to our president and says, this is not the first time or the second time or the third time we've been here. It's a great book. It's a great story. when you read chapter 4, it opens up like Jews when they grieve, and they're tearing their clothes, and they're putting on what would be like burlap to us, burlap clothes, just kind of a tent, a sackcloth and ashes, it's called, and they're throwing ashes for grief on their head, sometimes just dirt, and because there's like, woe is us, we have no fate before us except dirt itself. And they're moaning and groaning, and Mordecai, like all the other Jews in the entire kingdom, finds himself doing this, and Esther finds out about it because she has to ask what's going on because she is like literally living in an ivory tower. She doesn't know what's happened to her people. And so she has to ask and find out, you know, through messengers because she can't talk to her father figure, Mordecai. And so he sends message. He says, look, here's a copy of the decree. There's a 300,000 or 3,000 ton bounty on us of silver that the king rejected. He fills in all the details and he says this, you, Esther, you need to go to King Xerxes and appeal to him for mercy for your people. Wait, what? And this is how she responds to this. Chapter 4, verse 10. And then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, message back after saying, you're supposed to go to the king and beg for your people. All the king's officials and all the people in the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king, there is but one law. It makes him mad. And that will be that person will be put to death. Now, unless there's this one exception, the only exception is that the king would extend his golden scepter to him and that would spare his life. It's been 30 days since I've even seen the king, and I can't do anything about that. Esther is saying, let me remind you that I'm living through two laws. One, I won't tell anyone I'm a Jew. And two, I will not make the king mad. Mordecai, you just told me to, one, tell the king I'm a Jew, and two, make him mad. And so Mordecai responds back, the loving father figure who raised this child from when she was very young, says this, three truths that help motivate. The first one is, you're not going to survive this. Now listen, when we look at these verses, if you know anything about the book of Esther, if you know verses that you memorized in the book of Esther, it's from this section, and people, they don't understand the bigger context of it. That's why in your memory verse, you'll see an alternate sentence that I'd like for you to consider taking to mind. But look at verse 12 says, and when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer, do not think that because you are in the king's house that you alone of all the Jews will escape. What? Do not think that when there's a slaughter of Jews that you being in the king's house will be the only one that makes it through. Well, no one knows I'm a Jew. And Mordecai's saying, yet. Okay. The next one is, it says, it's going to happen anyway. Verse 14, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance of the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your father's family will perish. He said it again. Do you understand what Mordecai is saying? Mordecai is saying, I love you too much for you to stay a coward in this bigger context. Mordecai is bringing an aspect of love that it's not the stuff that you get on Hallmark cards. We were singing a few minutes ago, his love is strong. His love is strong. This is what's called tough love. And if you don't know what it is, you should. And it's probably pretty common that when other people are practicing tough love, that you judge them and say they're not loving because you don't know what it means. Tough love is when you tell someone the truth, even if it hurts them. Tough love is you tell someone the truth and you say, you're not as important as something bigger than you, like Israel and God's plan. Mordecai is threatening Esther's life. And whether he's doing it through the providence of God, look, it's going to be found out, or if he's saying in a veiled threat, I'll be the one who tells people that you're Jewish. But look how Mordecai's taking a lot of freedom away from Esther so that she can understand exactly where she is. So besides taking away a fair amount of freedom here in the first two comments, the last thing he does is he says, there's so much more to this. Look, this is the verse everyone seems to be familiar with. Verse 13b, and who knows that you have come to this royal position for such a time as this? Who knows? There's so much more going on here. Defining moments in people's lives usually consist of these two things, these three statements or two summary things. There's a loss of choice, and then there's an observation that you're part of something much bigger. I mean, Mordecai is saying, really? You think you're just lucky that you survived when your parents died? You think it was just luck that you were brought into the citadel at Susa and Haggai, the chief eunuch, liked you? You think it was just lucky that he gave you his best trainers? You think it was lucky that of all the women in all the kingdom, that Xerxes picked you? Come on, Esther. There's so much more happening here. And besides, you don't have a lot of choice. And so you need to do the right thing, not the comfortable thing. You need to become somebody else. Because the innocent orphan is getting old. Do you understand that that's how God works? That he can put us in situations that make us extremely uncomfortable with increasing levels of pressure so that we might become someone else? That we would be transformed? That's the way God works. And I want you to see what happens to her. Look at, this is the pivot of her life, verse 15 and 16. So when Esther heard the reply from Mordecai, listen, this is what she says. Go, gather together all the Jews in who are in Susa, and you fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Verse 17. And Mordecai went out and carried out Esther's orders immediately. She's changed. She's not carrying around that little flower anymore. She's lost her skip. Her shoulders have rolled back. You might remember from 8th grade, and then you had to be reminded in 11th grade, that in a narrative, there is really only one major character. And it's not the character that's talked about a lot. Doesn't necessarily have the most lines in a movie. The lead character, the major character, is the character that changes the most in a story. In this story, Esther is the main character. Mordecai will stay Mordecai. Xerxes will still be a crazy, drunk, mad king. Haman will be evil consistently all the way through. Esther, she changes night and day, and this is where it happens. Chapters 1 through 3, Esther, all the passive words are used for Esther, and then she obeyed, and then she went, and then she did what she was told, and then she took advice. And then, chapter 4, after a threat of loss of freedom and loss of life and seeing the bigger picture of why she was even in the palace in the first place, now she's barking out orders. She's the one that's telling people what to do. And that's the way it'll be for the rest of this book. There's a scary side of her I can't wait for you to meet. But look at verse 17. I just want you to see it again. And then Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's orders. Now who's telling who what to do? Here's what one Hebrew scholar said. He says, in the traumatic ordeal that Esther faced, initially a beautiful young woman with weak character becomes transformed into a person with heroic and moral stature and political skills. She takes charge. What does it take to change a person? What does it take to change you? Or someone you really love? What are the ingredients? Not change behavior, but change nature. I would say it's in this book. There's a loss of freedom, and then there's an understanding that you're part of a bigger story, and the story is not you. It's not about you. And you could choose to be a minor player in a huge story. And listen, here's the thing. God, I want you to see that God arranges circumstances that causes a bit of a pressure cooker in your life or in the lives of the people you love, that it gets greater and greater so that you can't stay where you are. You can't stay who you are. And it looks like this. Look, the present pain becomes greater than the future fear. And so God just keeps turning the pressure up or the volume up or the heat up or whatever it is at work, at play, sometimes at school, in your family. And I want you to hear something, you guys. Listen to me. The Mordecais in your life will come in and they will not write you a check because they know God is the one who puts you in that situation. Through your own choices a lot of times, so you can see the cause effect. But Mordecais that understand love that's strong, love that's tough, love that can transform will just pat, they will stand there with you. They'll speak truth to you. Like, you know what? Maybe it's time that you grow out of the innocent orphan phase. And maybe all this stuff that's going on around you isn't necessarily evil. It's just hard. And it's so that you will move on. And maybe you're part of something so much bigger that doesn't include you as the center of the stage. See, God holds class for transformation, and it's located right between a rock and a hard place. And that's where things have the potential to change. And well-meaning new Christians, they don't understand that. And so they come in and they rescue and they write checks and they get you out of trouble. And it's the very thing that God had been working for years, maybe months, weeks, to get you to. It's like being, the metaphor of being born again is really good, because being born, you gotta wonder, a baby, a fetus is just like, oh, I'm liking this. I mean, I don't even have to walk anywhere. It's not too bright in here, and I don't even have to breathe, and I'm nurtured and nourished. And there comes a time where the mom says, nah, it's time for you to go. And you need to see the light of day and breathe your own, you know, air and take your own food, because we're done here. You ladies know, and in August especially, that can feel like it's time. But you have to go through the process of being afraid and in pain and suffering, and then you're born. And that's how being born again is, honestly. You hit these walls and you stall out, and people that know what love is, they confront you and they say, you can't stay this way anymore. You can't be you anymore. And maybe if you saw that there's something bigger in life than you, you could be born again. And being born again, at Grace Covenant Church, we talk about being born again the first time, which is for salvation, where you trust Christ for the payment of your sin and you get into his family. But we have found over and over again, because we think it's in the Bible, in Galatians, what you begin in the Spirit, you keep going that way. And so you surrender your life to Christ, you become part of his family, your sins are forgiven, but you still have a temper, and that's got to change. At some point in your life, your family or your friends, your coworkers say, you know what, we're not letting you live with your temper anymore. We're going to let you live with consequences instead of paying for your consequences. or your greed, or your financial irresponsibility, or your vanity, or your pride. And they're part of they're the Mordecais in your life, and they're helping God put the pressure on. And you know what? Here's the thing. If you see yourself as a small part of a bigger picture, it gives you the freedom to be part of God's will, God's kingdom, God's purpose. That's the story of this book. That's what Mordecai's lesson was, wasn't it? That God has a plan for his people, and you can be part of that, Esther. Let me tell you, God has a plan for his people, his kingdom, and you can be part of that plan. It is not his ambition to make you comfortable. That is not it. He wants to make you Christ-like. He wants you to make you a courageous king. He wants to take the milquetoast, innocent little orphan child and turn you into a courageous queen who will face a crazy king. And if you die, you die. What a way to die, though, right? There's not a possibility of a bad ending to this story. She goes to see the king. She dies. She goes to the city of the king and she lives. We'll have to see next week if she lives or dies. But she's already decided she's going to see this king. His kingdom will come. His will be done. Oh, it will be done. He's asking, do you guys want to be part of that? What do you have to become? Because he's bigger than the thing you're afraid of. He's stronger than the addiction that you have towards anger or impatience or pride or some chemical. He just wants you to get to a place where you realize you don't have a choice to sit and stay. So here's the application of the day. It's kind of twofold. One is, are you Esther? Have you realized that maybe the circumstances in your life, the painful ones, the feeling of a conspiracy against you are actually maybe God's way of telling you it's time to be transformed by his grace? Today, you could just say, okay, I get it now. Okay. And I want to be part of your big story, God, not my story. Let it die. Are you Esther? Embrace that. Stop shaking your fist and fighting. Just resolve. Second, another little kind of a weird application here for us, but are you maybe Mordecai in this story? Are you very close to someone and you realize maybe you've been enabling, not helping? You're like keeping them in a bad place instead of applying pressure to take away freedom, to force them into a rebirth. That's strong love. That's tough love. It's real love to say to someone, I can't help you out of this situation because I think if I do, you won't grow. And I want you to see that God's kingdom needs you to be on the other side of this. Maybe you're a Mordecai. So let me just close in this prayer. Come back next week. We've got to figure out if she lives or dies. See how this story ends. But let me close today and just ask God's Spirit to tell us if we're a Mordecai or an Esther, and then we could live up to the way God works. Dear Heavenly Father, this is the way you work. And so you've worked in our lives. And so there's the Esthers in this room. And Lord, I'd ask that you'd help them see that there is a conspiracy that's making work or home a tremendously difficult place to be. And maybe it's because it's our fault that we've been wanting to live as queens in ivory towers and be pampered and ignorant of all the world that's going on around us. And now you're giving us this wake-up call to be caring and compassionate beyond we could ever imagine, to look outside of our own selves to serve your kingdom and not our own. And Lord, I'd ask that those people that are living in Esther's world right now, that they would see that there's great things to be had if we surrender the addiction to comfort and ignorance. And Lord, the Mordecais, they need strength too, because they're going to be misunderstood and even gossiped about and hated because they understand what strong and tough love looks like. Lord, would you give us the words, the compassionate words, to say the hard things so that we could help be part of that rebirth process in someone else's life. God, we're grateful that you didn't leave us here not knowing the way you work, that we wouldn't have to be afraid or ignorant about the way you work in Esther's life is the way you're working in our lives. So give us the vision to see that. In Jesus' name, amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.